want to welcome Gavin O'Donnell to Upcoming Dis. He's the writer of The Execution, Life and Times of Patrick O'Donnell. And I want to welcome you to Upcoming Dis. How are you doing, Gavin?
Hello, Gino. It's really good to be here. Thank you.
And we're talking to you all the way from Wales, correct?
That's right. I'm here on the other side of the Atlantic, sitting in my bedroom come office.
Well, I have to tell you, if my information is correct, you were a first-time novelist. Is that right?
It's right, yeah. This is my first attempt at writing a novel, so be gentle with me.
I certainly will. And the person that we're talking about here in this novel is a specific historical novel. It's got something to do with actual historical events, and I want to get to something you talk about in the prologue or in your introduction, and that is you talk about these genre distinctions. You say either historical fiction or creative nonfiction. Can you tell the audience a little bit about what you mean by those terms?
Yeah, I'll do my best. Historical fiction, of course, is taking of events in history which are real and some that aren't real, and weaving into them a narrative which gives a story. It can be as diverse as something like Dracula, for example. In Dracula, even though it's obviously fiction, there are historical elements which are true, but the primary element of the story is fiction. So historical fiction is more of a fiction with a historical skeleton to it, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
What's developed in more recent years, and why I refer to narrative non-fiction, is that you can write a book which has so much truth in it and so many true events and historical events that the element of fiction, if you like, is so minimal, or the element of creativity is so minimal, that it's better characterized as a non-fiction, but one that's creative, which is perhaps a little bit of a cheat, because, to be fair,
yeah,
the thing should really be described as historical fiction. So mm-hmm. I guess one is more fiction than the other. There is a lot of narrative non-fiction currently being written and turned into films and so forth. So it is a very, very much an increasing genre. I chose to go for them to define my book as fiction because I didn't want people chasing me, telling me that didn't happen, this didn't happen. Because a lot of it did happen.
Right, so, certainly. And your main character, who's am I pronouncing his real Irish name, Patrick? Is that how you pronounce it?
Well, his name in English is Patrick O'Donnell, but okay. It would be Padraig. The Irish pronunciation of Patrick, Padraig.
Okay.
Patrick the book is written in English, and although I do use a couple of Irish terms, it's primarily in English, well, almost all in English.
Yeah. Now, the name of this guy is Patrick O'Donnell, and if I'm not missing my information here, he is a true historical figure. This man actually shot someone. He actually did get sent to Newgate Prison. He had a trial. He was condemned to death. He was hung, and he also had two big figures of the time, Victor Hugo, the author, and the American president, Chester Arthur, both went to the courts on his behalf, trying to get his sentence at least commuted to something less harsh. So these are things that we start with that are absolutely true, correct?
Absolutely correct. The book starts with Patrick in a prison cell. Patrick O'Donnell is a very well-known historical figure, not just in Ireland and Britain, but also in your own Pennsylvania. He
yes.
lived for a while in the coal fields of Pennsylvania. There are monuments to him there. And he really did take part in the rather gruesome murder of a chap, which we'll come to.
Mm-hmm.
He was also sentenced to death and spent his time in Newgate Prison, where this story is set. But although the story is set in Newgate Prison, it's a reflection of his entire life while he's sitting waiting for the hangman.
Right.
It really did exist, yeah.
And he's telling his story through a series of letters that he's intending for Victor Hugo to read, either in thanks for his help or at least to try to, you know, give him something back, I assume, for his help in trying to get him off of the hangman's noose. Is that correct?
Yeah, and again, that's another factual element to the story. Patrick left Ireland during the famine and spent most of his life in the United States,
right,
where he acquired citizenship. So he was an American citizen, and that's why the president at the time intervened with the court, while he actually wrote to Queen Victoria, asking for clemency, because he believed he could get that on the basis that Patrick was an Irish in the what amounted to an Irish peasant in a death cell was having such high level debate about his fate,
mm-hmm.
ongoing during the trial and after it, and that is a fact that happened.
Yeah, and so the story is written through two kind of perspectives. We have these letters that he supposedly is writing while he's awaiting his fate. And then we have a narrator, and that narrator comes between each of these, I call them chapters, each of these letters chapters, and he gives us a little bit of an explanation maybe about what we're going to read. He corrects some things that might be historically inaccurate or that he's learned has been inaccurate. And this is the way the story's told from beginning to end. Now, you had to come up with two voices here. In writing the letters, you're speaking from the voice of Patrick, who's in this death cell in Newgate Prison. Then as the narrator, you're speaking as someone who's now maybe in the present, who's now telling us maybe the true story or giving us, you know, a little bit of extra information behind the scenes. So how did you accomplish the separation of these two voices that had to be very distinct and very consistent throughout the narration?
It's a good question. It is quite hard to write anything, as most writers will tell you. You know, it's a challenge because what you're trying to do is produce something entertaining,
sure.
informative, not boring. So I initially came up with the letters, and to write as a 19th century Irish man stuck in a prison cell is you have to put yourself there, and literally. In my head, that's what I do. I put myself there.
Yeah.
Imagine the dampness. Imagine the unpleasantness of it, and so on and so forth. I'm lucky in a way because I wrote that part of the book, and then a very kind agent suggested to me that I should insert what we call epigraphs, so the introductions, if you like, to the chapters.
Right.
They're more than introductions. They're introductions to each chapter, and they're explanations of the previous chapter. And because I did that in a different time, and I did it. By reading the existing work, I was able, I guess, to be detached. And I think I studied law as a young man, well, not a young man, when I was 40 years old, and I think it helped a lot because I'm able to look at something clinically and dissect it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the approach I took. So, for example, when Patrick is describing the secession of the Southern states in the Civil War, I've deliberately allowed him to make mistakes.
Right.
And then corrected those mistakes. And it lends a certain a lot of authenticity to what you're reading. You remember, the aim of this book isn't to educate. It isn't to correct people or to change history.
Of course not.
To entertain, and that's what I think we've managed to achieve.
Yeah, you did. And you know, when I'm reading a book of this nature, while I'm being entertained by it, I think that one of the things that happens is that, and you talk about this in your introduction as well, about how we sometimes come to history through some fictional story, through a movie we've seen or a book we've read or even a song that we might have heard, leads us to maybe further investigate an historical event. And this happened around, I'm from Reading, Pennsylvania, which is where the Reading Railroad was, which plays a real antagonistic role in some of this story. And so even though it wasn't an historically completely accurate thing, it's accurate enough that it allows me to be immersed in there more, because now I'm in this historical event and there's enough truth there that I can live there with it and appreciate what's going on. And I assume that's part of what you're trying to do.
The historical accuracy is a layman's accuracy, if you like. So if you were to take 10 people from the Reading Railroad fiascos and events,
yeah.
and you were to ask each of the 10 to account for what happened, each of them would come with a completely different version.
Yes.
No, and depending on which side you were on, you know, and so forth. So history is very much a personal thing. And I believe that certainly I found in my lifetime, what I've learned most about history is from novels, not from their textbooks.
Right.
As I say, at the start, I learned about the charge of life because I didn't know what it was until I read George MacDonald Fraser's account of it.
Sure.
An accurate and very entertaining account. So, although my epigraphs do try to point people in the direction of correct, you know, historical fact, they're not meant to be absolute, you know, the be-all and end-all. They're just to say, look, to put in perspective, for example, I say in the Irish famine, 1 million people died in Ireland of starvation. 2 million left the country over a period of about 4 years.
Right.
And to put that in perspective, I also say that if that happened in Britain today, that would be the equivalent of 8 million people dying of starvation. And although that might be something we can all work out and we can all know,
sure. Right.
Not something people think about. So it's a very stark sort of a jolt, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
This is what was happening. So, and that's part, going back to the voice thing, that's part of the voice of the narrator, if you like, if we call the narrator the person in, who's resonant a little bit.
Right.
It's almost as if to say, not to tell you what to think, but to guide you, maybe, answer your question.
No, I think you've accomplished that, and to me, that's the joy of the book. That's the brilliance of the book, is that you're able to have your cake and eat it too. I suppose I can say is that you're able to tell this colorful story that doesn't necessarily have to worry so much about the facts, and then you have a guy who's telling us, okay, some of this isn't really the way it happened, but you get the idea of what he's doing because he's a human being. He's not a computer who held all these facts of his life in his head and can repeat them with that kind of accuracy. So it's a natural type of thing. But you're able to also give us someone who does have some of that information. And I love the idea of having both of those things happen and have it happen smoothly enough that I'm not being pulled out of the narrative.
That's so kind of you. It's lovely to hear that you feel that way, and I hope other people who read the book feel the same way. It isn't a lecture, it's a story.
Yes.
But in it, we learn about some of the tragedies of human existence, of the, what happened to the immigrants in America, and also the contribution they made. Funny enough, before this interview, I was having a little think about, you know, what you might ask me. And something I put on Facebook a little while ago about the book is that, you know, these people who landed in America, who came off these coffin ships with nothing but their clothes,
right,
for them with typhoid, dying on the feet of starved. 4 or 5 generations later, these people were presidents. They were civil servants. They were firemen. They were what, you know, they were the spine of America. They what built America. So they weren't nothing.
Yes.
They were everything. And
yeah.
It's easy to forget these people were where they were because they were subjugated for so long and treated so badly that, you know, they didn't eat like they were out of choice.
Yeah.
And I didn't want it to be an English bashing book. I didn't want to say how terrible the English are what they did, but can't possibly write an account of the Irish famine without bashing the English. It's just not possible.
Right.
Why? And it's the same with the American Civil War and various other things. You know, there's some really bad players, and
there are
really, you know, great players as well. And I hope that comes across in the book. That's why I put Patrick in a position where he starts out in the Civil War stage, where he's fighting for the Confederates.
Yeah.
And he gradually develops an understanding of what he's doing is wrong, and eventually completely converts to being what he is, or what he was.
Right.
That wasn't, I'd love to think that was my invention, but it's not. I believe, as we discussed before, that's something that happened to many, many people in the war.
Yes, and in these letters, he basically, to let our audience know, he's basically telling his life story. He begins pretty much from his birth, and he works himself up until what led him to where he was, and these are in letters to Victor Hugo. And I have a what-if question. This is very speculative, and I'm not sure if you thought about it, but it actually occurred to me several times as I was reading it. Had these letters been real, and had Victor Hugo had actually received these letters, do you think these letters would have changed his perspective on the case?
I think Victor Hugo might well, like all of us, look at some of the experiences Patrick had, and without giving too much away, we know that Patrick had some pretty gruesome experiences, not just the victim of them, but also the perpetrator of them.
Absolutely.
And I think that it may be, you know, I can't speak to Victor Hugo, other than I know he's a great writer, of course, but also that he was a great humanitarian.
He was.
The man was seriously, you know, credited with the abolition of the death sentence in several countries. So he was a humanitarian. He was also, I liked his views on religion as well, in believing in God and so forth, but less in the mechanism he's got on Earth. So I think he probably would have taken the view that this is a flawed man, he's made mistakes, being reckless, he's been silly, and so forth.
But
he's, like all of us, entitled to some sort of redemption.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's possibly, I mean, he wouldn't have been oblivious to Patrick's life, and obviously Patrick, we know, murdered another man.
Right, certainly.
He bullets in him.
Yeah.
So stance was he's against the death penalty,
right,
per se.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he would have probably taken the same position.
I think he would have taken the same position. Because and the reason I ask is because, of course, we know that that was the impetus behind his you know, trying to you know, be a on-behalf advocate for him. But also, he obviously didn't have time to advocate for every single person on death row. He picked Patrick, you know, for specific reasons unknown to us. And I wasn't, and I don't know why, but as I was reading these letters, I often wondered, okay, suppose Victor's reading these letters, and we know, of course, he didn't, and that these didn't happen that way, but it leads to that supposition, at least to me. I don't know if other readers will have that, but I know that question crossed my mind several times as I read the letters.
I would add, you know, that it's hard for, particularly people who aren't terribly well-versed about the Phoenix Park murders. I'll just briefly account. The Phoenix Park murders were the murder of two people. One of the men was called Lord Frederick Cavendish, who was the nephew,
right,
of Prime Minister Gladstone. Now, this gentleman, James Carey, was the leader of the murderers,
right,
and he was caught, and he gave Queen's evidence, and five of his compatriots hanged, and he went free.
Yes.
He was hated by the Irish, and he was hated by the English.
Yes.
But Patrick, of course, killed him.
Now, right.
That's almost a sideshow, if you like.
Yes.
The murder of Lord Frederick Cavendish in Phoenix Park in 1882,
right,
has by historians described as the JFK of the 19th century. So it was that big. And I think the reason Victor Hugo was involved or got involved is because it was reported worldwide. It was in the French papers. In fact, some of the photographs I have in the book, some of the
yes,
I have in the book, have come from French newspapers at the time.
Yes.
So it was such a big thing. So when you say, yeah, he couldn't intervene on everybody. I mean, they were hanging people left, right, and center.
Right.
And Patrick was the 16th person that year to be hanged in Britain. So they were, you know, he didn't intervene in all of. But although Patrick O'Donnell was less of an event, if you like, his hanging was less of an event than the Phoenix Park murders. I mean, we're talking about Gladstone's nephew,
right,
butchered in the park.
Royal family.
Literally with a surgeon's knife.
Yeah, we're talking the royal family here.
Well, you're talking about, he wasn't royal family, but close to it. I mean, Gladstone.
Right.
Well, I mean, Gladstone, when you talk about the aristocracy of Britain, Gladstone was up there.
Yeah.
Other incidentally, there's a slave owner. But the Lord Frederick Cavendish's elder brother was a man called Lord Harrington, the Duke of Devonshire.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the Duke is a big dude, you probably hear. He's like,
yeah.
I suppose I shouldn't say a big dude, but as aristocracy goes, apart
certain
from a king, you don't get any higher than a duke. So
right.
He's a very senior person, which of course throws up the question, which I invite, as you know.
Right.
If Patrick killed the man who killed Lord Frederick Cavendish, well, surely the English would have all in her favour. But I'll say no more about that just now.
And that's what they would have done if it hadn't been for the deal anyway.
Well, that's the thing. When he cut the deal, I mean, it was incredible that you could cut a deal and get basically Queen's evidence. They hanged five of the other conspirators.
Right.
But you have to ask the question, I mean, this was such a high person that was murdered.
Right.
How on earth did this man cut the deal? I mean, and he was put on a boat to South Africa, given money.
Right.
And it's almost as if you'd have to say, well, yeah, but there's no way they let him walk.
Right. Exactly, you would think.
Yeah, and you'd think it too, probably, and anybody else would have. Well, with a brain, would probably think the same thing. So, the book, in the later stages of the book, obviously we go into certain conjecture about what actually happened.
Right.
And I don't want to spoil the story for people, but there's more questions in terms of who it was and why it was.
Yeah.
This man was, I wouldn't say executed, but killed.
Yeah.
You remember, Patrick was, and again, I'm saying things possibly that, unless you've read the book, it's difficult to realize, but Patrick was on the same boat as James Carey, the man he murdered,
right,
for 3 weeks as they headed down towards the coast of Port Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if he wanted to kill him and get away with it, he could have thrown him overboard at any time.
Right, he had many opportunities, right.
He had many, many opportunities. He waited until he was in front of half the ship's crew
before
he shot the guy. So, what's that about? I mean, why? It's almost like maybe he was doing it thinking he had impunity.
Right.
Nobody can touch me. But again, I invite you readers to think what they want. I tell them my conclusion. The book makes a very strong conclusion.
Right. Yes.
People disagree with it.
I was just going to say, I think that's the power of it, is that I think that people can look at it, and it creates enough thought that it did cause me to speculate on things. And to me, that's the mark of good fiction, if it causes me to speculate. If at the end it's kind of I'm done and I move on to the next book, I don't think that's as enriching.
No, we all want to be stimulated.
Just a couple more quick questions. One is, a reader can't help but notice that Gavin O'Donnell shares a last name with Patrick O'Donnell. Can you tell us something about that?
Not guilty. I have reason to believe that there is some connection, but to be honest with you, it's very... I would never claim it.
Sure.
It's too tenuous a link. There is a very obvious line, if you like, but it's not unbroken.
Yeah.
And besides, it's not important. I mean, let's face it, half the people who from Donegal are called O'Donnell.
Yeah.
And the other half are O'Neill. But
right.
If I'd gone for non-fiction, I might have explored that more, but it's really not important. I've got to be honest with you, it's the reason I looked into the guy, because when my brother and I were very young, we talked about this a lot, and there was a picture of him in our house and so forth. But,
oh, okay.
And as I looked into it, it looked too tenuous, so I'm not, for the record, I'm not claiming his relation of mine.
No, the reason I ask is because this is your first novel. Something must have attracted you to this. Something must have pulled you towards this particular story to be the one that you're going to tell. And I was just wondering if any of that had anything to do with what might have piqued your interest.
Yeah, I mean, I thought he was likely related, and my brother Edward was very keen on this story. But I studied in Turner College for a while in Dublin, and mm-hmm. was young, and I studied the Phoenix Park murders, like everybody in Ireland.
Right.
It's like you studying Abe Lincoln. So, although I studied the Phoenix Park murders, would you believe the name Patrick O'Donnell never even came up? Patrick O'Donnell is such a is seen as a side thing to the whole palaver, if you like.
Ah.
I think it was the name was the thing that stimulated me mostly into looking at it. And I know, you know, I've written the book carefully, and I haven't suggested there's any relationship, but I wouldn't care if it was or wasn't.
Right. Well, but that's what I ask, because something must have, you know, I was wondering about what compelled you to start here, because being a first novelist. So now this is your first one. After this experience, are you going to go through it again?
Yeah, I am. I'll just correct you there. This is my first novel, but I wrote a book previous to this called Father's Day.
Right.
And it's a memoir. And it was more of a cathartic exercise. It's about the loss of a child. And
right.
Unfortunately, we lost a child years ago. And somebody suggested to me it would be useful to write about it, and I did, and I produced quite a volume, a bit of a self-indulgent volume of work, and I'm not sure I'll ever publish it. It's something that's more, as I say, more cathartic than literary, but what it did is give me the love, if you like, of writing. I absolutely love writing. I can't imagine why I waited 50 years. So much fun. I mean, can you think of any other way in the world, apart from dreaming, that you can change things and make them as you want? In a novel, you can literally do anything.
You're right.
You can fly. You can turn into a vampire and go under doors as Dracula. And you can build a robot. You can do what you want.
So
it's such a release for me, and such fun, that there's no way I'm stopping. I've got a couple of books I'm working on at the moment. One is a pirate story for my grandson, who's 7, and I'll be with him. I'll write a story about pirates for him, and another one is about it's a comedy about mental health illness.
Mm-hmm.
It's a serious issue, but I'm approaching it in a jokey sort of way.
Yeah,
and I've written a few short stories, one about Jack Daniels, one about another one for my grandson. So I'm always doing something, but I am toying with a. I can't really say what I'm toying with, because you give away the end of the story.
No, yes, please don't do that. Yeah.
No, I'm toying with maybe writing something else about Patrick.
Okay.
Because he's a very, very interesting guy. And,
he is indeed a very interesting guy.
When you're writing, sorry to interrupt you, but it's funny when you're writing.
Yeah.
You do form a relationship with your characters, and Patrick I really like, but of all the characters in my book, I adore Honora.
Uh-huh.
His friend, and she's just fantastic. And it is a bit odd, because she doesn't exist.
Right.
I think if you're a friend,
right.
I guess it's part of writing, isn't it? You sort of merge yourself deep into the story and become part of it almost, because you know, the same, most first novels are people writing about experiences they've had themselves.
Yeah, right, what you know. And for listeners out there who want to know who Nora is, because you brought her up, and of course we didn't speak about her, you're going to have to read this book, and I highly recommend the book. I enjoyed it. It was a fast read for me. I found that it was very difficult to put down. It was hard for me to find a place to just stop because I was compelled to continue. And I would very much like to read more about this character and more about in this style in which you've presented this. I think that our readers out there are going to really love it. I highly recommend the book, and I want to thank you from all the way in Wales taking the time to talk to us here at Upcoming Discs.
No, it's been a pleasure, you know. It's good of you to have me.
It was a pleasure to have you as well, and I look forward to something else from you down the future.